Hello and welcome to this week's Revisiting Old Favourites. And we are continuing on our pilgrimage to Rome, on the path to Rome with Hilaire Belloc. We left him last week asleep, heading down from the High Alps in Italy. And we will... We begin with him asleep, and we actually end again with him asleep today. In between, we have him waxing, as usual, in the presence of the Italian lakes, and we see him waxing on a dishonest man and an honest man, and then. Overcome by tiredness, which is actually, as I said, where we find him. So without further ado, continuing where we left off last time. I slept for 2 hours beneath that hedge, and when I awoke, the air was no longer a trembling furnace, but everything about me was wrapped round as in a cloak of southern afternoon and was still. The sun had fallen midway, and shone in steady glory through a haze that overhung Lake Major and the wide, luxuriant estuary of the Vale. There lay before me a long, straight road for miles at the base of high hills. Then, far off, this road seemed to end at the foot of a mountain called, I believe, Ashmount or Cinder Hill. But my imperfect map told me that here it went sharp round to the left, choosing a pass, and then at an angle went down its way to Lugano. Now Lugano was not 15 miles as the crow flies from where I stood, and I determined to cut off that angle by climbing the high hills just above me. They were wooded only on their slopes. Their crest and much of their sides were a downland of parched grass, with rocks appearing here and there. At the first divergent lane, I made off eastward from the road and began to climb. In under the chestnut trees, the lane became a number of vague beaten paths. I followed straight upwards. Here and there were little houses standing hidden in the leaves, and soon I crossed the railway, and at last above the trees I saw the site of all the Bellinzona valley to the north, and turning my eyes I saw it broaden out between its walls to where the lake lay very bright in spite of the slight mist, and this mist gave the lake distances, and the mountains round about it were transfigured and seemed part of the mere light. The Italian lakes have that in them and their air which removes them from common living. Their beauty is not the beauty which each of us sees for himself in the world. It is rather the beauty of a special creation, the expression of some mind. To eyes innocent, and first freshly noting our great temple inheritance, I mean to the eyes of a boy and girl just entered upon the estate of this glorious earth, and thinking themselves immortal, this shrine of Europe might remain forever in the memory, an enchanted experience, in which the single sense of sight had almost touched the boundary of music. They would remember these lakes as the central emotion of their youth. To mean men also who, in spite of years and of a full foreknowledge of death, yet attempt nothing but the satisfaction of sense, and pride themselves upon the taste and fineness with which they achieve this satisfaction. The Italian lakes would seem a place for habitation, and there such a man might build his house contentedly. But to ordinary Christians, I am sure there is something unnatural in this beauty of theirs, and they find in it either a paradise only to be won by a much longer road, or a bait and veil of sorcery, behind which lies great peril. Now, for all we know, beauty beyond the world may not really bear this double aspect. But to us on earth, if we are ordinary men, beauty of this kind has something evil. Have you not read in books how men, when they see even divine visions, are terrified? So as I looked at Lake Major in its halo, I also was afraid. And I was glad to cross the ridge and crest of the hill and to shut out that picture framed all round with glory. While I take a sip of tea, please permit the parenthesis. That was beautiful prose and a beautiful meditation on the beauty of God's creation. To continue. But on the other side of the hill, I found, to my great disgust, not, as I had hoped, a fine slope down leading to Lugano, but a second interior valley and another range just opposite me. I had not the patience to climb this, so I followed down the marshy land at the foot of it, passed round the end of the hill, and came upon the railway, which had tunnelled under the range I had crossed. I followed the railway for a little while, and at last crossed it, penetrated through a thick brushwood, forded a nasty little stream, and found myself again on the main road, wishing heartily I had never left it. It was still at least 7 miles to Lugano, and though all the way was downhill, yet fatigue threatened me. These shortcuts over marshy land and through difficult thickets are not shortcuts at all, and I was just wondering whether, although it was already evening, I dared not rest a while when there appeared at a turn in the road a little pink house with a yard all shaded over by a vast tree. There was also a trellis making a roof over a plain bench and table, and on the trellis grew vines. Into such houses, I thought, the gods walk when they come down and talk with men, and such houses are the scenes of adventures. I will go in and rest. So I walked straight into the courtyard and found there a shriveled, brown-faced man with kindly eyes who was singing a song to himself. He could talk a little French, a little English, and his own Italian language. He had been to America and to Paris. He was full of memories. And when I had listened to these and asked for food and drink, and said I was extremely poor and would have to bargain, he made a kind of litany of, "I will not cheat you. I am an honest man. I also am poor," and so forth. Nevertheless, I argued about every item, the bread, the sausage and the beer. Seeing that I was in necessity, he charged me about 3 times their value, but I beat him down to double, and lower than that he would not go. Then we sat down together at the table, and ate and drank and talked of far countries, and he would interject remarks on his honesty compared with the wickedness of his neighbours, and I parried with illustrations of my poverty and need, putting up the 4 francs odd that remained to me and jingling them sorrowfully in my hand. "With these," I said, "I must reach Milan." Then I left him, and as I went down the road, a slight breeze came on and brought with it the coolness of evening. At last, the falling plateau reached an edge. Many little lights glittered below me, and I sat on a stone and looked down at the town of Lugano. It was nearly dark. The mountains all around had lost their mouldings and were marked in flat silhouettes against the sky. The new lake, which had just appeared below me, was bright as water is at dusk, and far away in the north and east, the high Alps still stood up and received the large glow of evening. Everything else was full of the coming night, and a few stars shone. Up from the town came the distant noise of music. Otherwise, there was no sound. I could have rested there a long time, letting my tired body lapse into the advancing darkness and catching in my spirit the inspiration of the silence, had it not been for hunger. I knew by experience that when it is very late, one cannot be served in the eating houses of poor men. I had not the money for any other. So I rose and shambled down the steep road into the town, and there I found a square with arcades, and in the southeastern corner of this square just such a little tavern as I required. Entering, therefore, and taking off my hat very low, I said in French to a man who was sitting there with friends and who was the master, "Sir, what is the least price at which you can give me a meal?" He said, "What do you want?" I answered, "Soup, meat, vegetables, bread, and a little wine." He counted on his fingers while all his friends stared respectfully at him and me. He then gave orders, and a very young and beautiful girl set before me as excellent a meal as I had eaten for days. And he charged me but a franc and a half. He gave me also coffee and a little cheese, and I, feeling hearty, gave threepence over for the service, and they all very genially wished me a good night. But their wishes were of no value to me, for the night was terrible. I had gone over 40 miles. How much over, I did not know. I should have slept at Lugano, but my lightning purse forbade me. I thought, I will push on and on. After all, I have already slept, and so broken the back of the day. I will push on till I am at the end of my tether, then I will find a wood and sleep. Within 4 miles, my strength abandoned me. I was not even so far down the lake as to have lost the sound of the band at Lugano floating up the still water, when I was under an imperative necessity for repose. It was perhaps 10 o'clock, and the sky was open and glorious with stars. I climbed up a bank on my right, and searching for a place to lie, found one under a tree near a great telegraph pole. Here was little parched grass, and one could lie there and see the lake and wait for sleep. It was a benediction to stretch out all supported by the dry earth, with my little side bag for pillow, and to look at the clear night above the hills, and to listen to the very distant music, and to wonder whether or not, in this strange southern country, there might not be snakes gliding about in the undergrowth. Caught in such a skein of influence, I was soothed and fell asleep. So we began with a sleeping Belloc, and we end with a sleeping Belloc, and in between we had a tired Belloc and a very, very poor Belloc, in the midst, nonetheless, of great beauty, and all of which was expressed with beautiful English. Thanks so much for joining me in this latest episode, if that's the right word, latest installment, latest leg on our long haul pilgrimage across Europe with Hilaire Belloc at the turn of the last century, over 100 years ago. And until next time, thanks as always for joining me, and Lenten blessings.